Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Manager unveils a budget in which the property tax rate is revenue neutral, but goodies abound. Early voting ends today in the GOP primary in the 9th District special election. Election day is next Tuesday, and the candidates have held their final debate. We'll hear all about it. Tom Tillis gets a GOP challenger in his race for U.S. Senate. CMPD updates its body cam video policy, and South Carolina races the clock in its decision on incentives to bring the Panthers south. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here from the Charlotte Observer. Hello.
Good morning.
Mary C. Curtis joins us from rollcall.com and WCCB-TV News Rising.
Good morning.
Can we do the show sitting? Okay? And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good to see you. We're all on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live this morning. We had City Manager Marcus Jones on the program this week, along with Mayor Vi Lyles, to talk about the $2.6 billion city budget for the next fiscal year. The good news is that Marcus Jones is recommending the property tax rate stay at a revenue-neutral level, meaning that even though the value of your property may have increased because of the recent revaluations, they've lowered the millage rate to keep your tax bill relatively the same for most but not all owners, at least in the city, not the county. We're talking about something different. Mayor Lyles told us this will be welcome news to taxpayers, but that's not all.
This community expected, with the growth and the development, that we shouldn't have an increase in our taxes.
Now, I can't speak for all Charlatans, but I did expect an increase in our taxes because that's just the way government seems to work. But she's not
cynicism, Mike. You've made me sad on her front.
Well, because the county had already announced an increase, so I just thought the city would follow suit. So they didn't. How were they able to hold the line while the county was not?
I think that one thing is that the county budget that was unveiled last week was so aggressive in new spending and so bold and putting out new social programs and growing social programs. They grew their spending by 9%. The city's is going to grow, I think, by about 5.
Yep.
And so it was just kind of a different priority. And remember last year, you know, the county, all three Republicans lost. It's a 9-0 Democratic board, and so I think that budget kind of reflected their priorities.
Dangerous is that for those 9 Democrats?
Well, I think it depends what district you're in. You know, if you're perhaps in the south of Charlotte, I think you might be facing some problems. There probably will be a lot of talk about taxes in the next election. But look, remember, even though they were small increases last year, both the city and the county raised taxes. I think the county was something like 0.75 cents, and I think it was a penny for the city. So you're right in the sense that it has become much more acceptable. Mike, you remember the time when city managers and county managers would routinely say, oh, no, we don't raise taxes. You know, we haven't raised taxes in 7 years or 8 years. That string was broken around the time of the recession, and I think since then it's become a lot more acceptable for taxes to go up.
So, Steve, Marcus,
people are crying right now.
Marcus Jones, the city manager, said on this program earlier this week that one of the things the city has as a goal is to maintain its stock and increase its stock of affordable housing, and you can't do that if you raise taxes all the time because that makes housing unaffordable. And he said that the city was particularly worried about long-time homeowners in areas where values have significantly increased, and those would be areas prone to gentrification. Is that right?
That's right. So one of the things I think that's interesting about this budget season and the reval, which we just had, let's say if you lived in Piper Glen or Foxcroft down in South Charlotte, very nice neighborhoods, your taxes are probably going to go down.
Really?
Yes.
I mean,
they're still very high, but they will go down. But if you live, you know, say in like these neighborhoods just west of uptown, you're going to see some pretty big increases. And going back like 6 or 7 years ago, that was kind of the city's goal in a way. There was this period where District 6 and 7, which is the South Charlotte wedge, they paid for almost the entire city. And there was this big push that we need to spread the tax burden around. They've done that. like, hooray, it worked. But of course, that is really painful for a lot of long-time homeowners.
So we're talking about the city budget, and the county budget is definitely calling for property tax increases. So you have to balance whatever you get or not get from the city with the county, because your taxes are probably going to go up no matter where you live. But in the city, what is the average person going to see on their tax bill from the city? Do we know?
Eric, I think, didn't they say, like, I mean, it's still going to be more than half will pay.
Yeah, it was 69% of people will pay more. The difference is that it's very marginal in comparison to what your tax rates will be with a county. So you'll pay more, but you'll pay slightly more.
And there was also, I'll just say one more thing. There was a period 10 years ago, water bills never went up. That was also a thing, right, where, like, they stayed the same. Now, every year they go up.
Solid waste fees go up pretty consistently.
So the city's able to, like, you know, kind of celebrate the tax rate not going up, but the fees go up every year.
Right.
It's funny, you know.
And a fee is a tax.
Yeah. And sitting in these meetings, it's always, the fees are always kind of at the end. It's kind of mumbled at the end. It's like, hey, the taxes are neutral. And by the way, you're going to pay $220. Yeah, you know, yeah. So.
Don't have a swimming pool and don't water the lawn.
Yes.
So despite keeping this budget revenue neutral, the city was still able to jam-pack this budget full of goodies. What are some of the things in it that people are going to be pretty pleased about if you work for the city, among other things?
Well, if you work for the city, the thing you're going to be pleased about are the raises. Yeah. And they've done something really interesting with the raises. And Marcus Jones laid all this out in the form of economic mobility and said that has to start in their own house, in essence. And he said that everyone above $70,000 at the city will get a 3% raise. Everyone below $70,000 will get a dollar an hour raise, because that equates to a much larger raise than if you just did the 3% at the bottom end. And so what that does in effect is it takes the $15 minimum wage at the city to $16 an hour. They just did the 15, I think, 2 years ago, Steve.
And that was a big deal, to get everyone up to 15, the so-called living wage, and now they're pushing it even higher.
And so by doing that, you get that dollar an hour, you get a $2,000 a year raise rather than a $900 a year raise. So you can see they're definitely keeping an eye on the things that they're talking about policy-wise with the broader city.
Mary.
Yeah, that goes on also with the police and fire workers, the police officers. They've talked about having trouble recruiting police and keeping staffing up. So they have raises in there for police officers. Also for training, of course, we've had certain incidents in the city, the shootings and so forth, that they've talked about increasing training for police officers. So that's in there too.
Yeah, there's 5% evidently for all police sergeants and a 5% pay increase in top pay for officers, a 2.5% increase for all fire captains, and they're trying to bring these people up to equity in terms of what other cities of like size pay, and also to retain them, to attract and retain them.
And there's an interesting note in there, Mike, in that with public safety, and of course police and fire are on a different pay system, but typically the city has compared itself to southeastern cities and has fared well. And this time, with their economists, they compared Charlotte to 20 cities across the country and found they were 7 to 12% below what those areas were paying, and they attribute that to some of the recruiting problems they're having.
So here's where it gets fun. They found money in here for the Cross Charlotte Trail, if you recall. The city leaders were surprised to discover, lo and behold, we're $77 million short on the funding for the Cross Charlotte Trail, and that means they couldn't do some of it. Well, they found $54 million to put into this trail.
That's a big sofa.
Now, evidently, I did the math on this, and evidently $54 million does not equal the $77 million shortfall by about $23 million.
Your calculations, I think, are pretty good there.
I did the math.
That's good.
I used a pencil and a piece of paper, and I did the math. But then I brought this up to Marcus Jones, and I don't understand the answer. I got lost there because he said, when I asked him, what's this going to do? He said, well, we never knew that the $77 million was really $77 million, because these last two projects, we have no idea what they were going to cost, because we don't even know what they're going to be. What?
Yeah, so the city is scrambling. This started at the retreat in January with talking about the Cross Charlotte Trail and other projects, about how they didn't know what things were going to cost, and the way that estimates were done in the past were not accurate. And so at least what the current regime is saying is they're going to do more vetting before they put a price tag on something and take it to council. And so what they're doing with the Cross Charlotte Trail in particular is they've got, I can't remember how many segments, but the majority of segments they've got priced out and they think is accurate.
Yeah, there's like two segments way up at the right. very end in northeast Charlotte, segments 10 and 11. I think that's where he said, we don't know how much those are going to cost. We thought it would equal 77. We know we can do 90% of the trail for 54.
So the $77 million figure was shocking, and it was floating around there for months, and now we're saying that that may not be an accurate figure.
Well, you can bet it's going to be more than $77 million. Because look, he's already said $54 million. He's got two segments left to do, or they've got two segments left to do. And what the city manager is saying is they're going to take 2 years to study and vet those last two segments to get an accurate figure so that they know how much money they have to find in the next SOFA so that they can finish this thing.
Okay, so will the fact that the city was able to hold the line on a property tax increase cause the county to rethink what they're going to do with taxes, or is that a done deal for the county, too late to make any major changes?
No, they can. I mean, they've got another month. I mean, they could tweak it and go back, and and I think if they feel enough pressure, they can dial it back and certainly do that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, they both vote in June, so they've got until June.
Because County Manager Dina DiIorio will be on this program on Tuesday.
Oh, that's lucky.
I'm hoping she brings along Trevor Fuller. We'll ask that question. Are you going to change it in light of what the city has been able to do, Mary?
Yeah, I was just saying that one piece of it I think is interesting in the budget. They're putting in money for workforce development. They're realizing that a lot of the salaries in the city and the jobs aren't able to meet the rising cost of living. So they're talking about training people for entry-level city jobs. And also, you know, to help folks who might have a record, things like that. So they seem to be looking to try to help in some way the income inequality.
Here's
in the
other thing I got confused about when I talked to our city manager earlier this week. I asked him how we, the city, could spend more money on things like salaries and the Cross Charlotte Trail and other things while keeping the tax rate the same. In other words, we're keeping it revenue neutral. We're not going to bring in substantially more money through raising taxes. How can we do all these other goody things? And he said, it's because of growth. There are more people moving in, more people paying taxes. We can do that. Now, in previous conversations I've had with previous managers, both county and city, they say growth, there's a lag time between growth and when the tax evens things out, because you've got to have infrastructure and things like that. And they always blamed increasing taxes on growth. So which is it?
I think it's, heads I win, tails you lose.
Yes.
A little bit. Like when, but one thing to the manager's point, the city and the county are also funded partially from sales tax. So the economy is booming, and so they can bring in a lot more money. Just people out shopping. And
I misspoke a moment ago. I said I hope that Dina DiIorio, the county manager, when she joins us on Tuesday, will bring Trevor Fuller along. She can bring him if she wants. What I meant to
you
say
meant
was
George Dunlap.
George Dunlap, yes. Who's the chair of the county commission. We have to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking about the 9th District. That special election primary is actually going on. Today is the last day that you can early vote, and Election Day is next Tuesday. A lot to talk about because those candidates, what are there, 10 candidates? They met in a big debate, and we'll talk about some of the things that they had to say. And Tom Tillis has a challenger on the Republican side of the aisle for his bid to be reelected to the United States Senate. Just a couple of the things we'll be talking about when we come back. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis, a columnist and contributor to both Roll Call and WCCB-TV, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor with the Charlotte Business Journal, who take this next 90 seconds to manage a little thing. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Katie Peralta is here from The Observer, Steve Harrison from our newsroom, Mary C. Curtis from rollcall.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. GOP candidates running in the special election in the 9th Congressional District met for their final debate before the end of early voting, which is today, and before next Tuesday's election day. That debate was hosted by conservative talk radio station WBT. But Steve, you say that was not a friendly venue. How so?
It really wasn't. It was like, I mean, do you remember 2 years ago during the Republican presidential debates when some of the best ones were on Fox and it was like this kind of like family affair where the host like really got after it? And so that was the way it was Tuesday night in this 9th district debate. There were some really hard questions put to the candidates. And
from Mark Garrison.
That's right. Yeah. Just and like relentless again and again and again. And it made for really good radio.
Okay. Mark Garrison asked former Mecklenburg County Commissioner Matthew Ridenour, this is the question of the year, why none of his former colleagues on the commission like him? Why they're not endorsing him? What was his response to that?
He seemed a little unprepared for that. And
I'd say.
And he kind of talked about
that was politely put.
You know, Jim Puckett was one of those colleagues who was not endorsed him. And, you know, he kind of said, well, Jim has his way. It's his way or the highway, and we differ. But there were others. I mean, Lee Brown, the realtor from Cabarrus County, got question after question about all the you know, the $1 million she's gotten from realtors.
The way he put that question was essentially, did you have a quid pro quo? You know, was it that they would raise the money and then you would run? And she was not happy with that question, I think.
And she said no, and then he kind of asked again.
Yeah.
And again.
Were those fair questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Just unexpected because they expected this to be a friendly venue?
I mean, I think maybe that, you know, the questions about the realtor money was probably in some form expected because that's been talked about a lot. But some of the other stuff, like the one that Matthew Ridenour got, was a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, it was a pointed question.
And also about residency. He really got on her about that.
She doesn't live in the district, but she has a house in the district.
Yeah,
right?
Well.
Yeah. But you don't have to live in the district.
No,
to run
it's
for
true.
Congress.
And they said
five
that
of the
too.
Ten don't, right?
Yes,
Mary?
Quite a few.
And Matthew Ridenour didn't just get it from Mark Garrison, the moderator. He got it from candidates who chided him for his slogan, "It takes a Marine to beat a Marine," which is an allusion to a way that he can take one of Democrat Dan McCready's talking points away from him, because Dan is a both of them are Marines. And Stevie Rivenbark jabbed, "So I'm fearful as a Republican whether we can go toe to toe with the Marine conversation." And she said that because I'm trying to think. He said that because he was beaten by a Democratic female academic in his county commission race. Is there something wrong with being a Democratic female academic?
I think in a Republican debate, that would probably be a jab,
but Steven,
right?
Stevie Rivenbark is a woman.
Yes. I'm not agreeing with her opinion, but I think that in that setting, that's, you know, clearly that's taking a shot at
it. It was pretty much saying,
yeah,
like, you let a girl beat you.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
that's pretty much what it was.
Right.
Yeah.
What kind of a Marine
are
you?
Yeah.
So did he have a comeback for that? This is nasty.
I think on that one, it was like a multi-part question, and he just said it was a tough loss. Okay. I've moved on. It was hard, but
there were a lot of answers about that's in the past. It was like Mark McGuire's old testimony before Congress. Well, let's talk about the future,
Mr. Bishop. Oh, that HB2. That's right. That's in the past.
That's
the past. No, it's
oh,
the
good.
Media.
You get to feed the jar.
There
you
go.
First person to say it, because that we're going to talk about Dan Bishop. State Senator Dan Bishop was asked about his co-sponsorship of the notorious House Bill 2, which nullified parts of Charlotte's non-discrimination ordinance for the gay, lesbian, and transgender community, and which resulted in international publicity, mostly negative, and the loss of business around the state. Here's Bishop's response to that.
HB2 was in 2016. It was resolved in 2017. Everybody knows where I stood. I've taken scrutiny on that nationally and actually internationally. I think people are ready to move on from that particular. There are new issues.
Mm-hmm. But fellow candidate Lee Brown, that realtor from Cabarrus County, disagreed with Bishop's downplaying of HB2.
I do believe Dan Bishop is going to have a challenge in the general because of HB2. And frankly, it's because our economy suffered when that circus was going on in the media, right or wrong.
I know it's a clever tactic for Republicans to work the media into anything that makes them look bad, but the media was not responsible for the circus. They were. That aside, which one of them is right? Is all forgiven about HB2? Have voters moved on? Or will HB2 resonate with voters other than Democrats who will vote in the general election?
The term resolved was really interesting to me because there is still like 5 states that have travel bans to North Carolina. So it's still very much an issue for people who are considering coming to the state and deciding not to. I've talked to people in the film industry who've said, I know that you guys say that this is resolved, but we still don't want to be in North Carolina because of the stain of this thing and the fact that the reputation remains, and it wasn't fully repealed, if you guys remember. I mean, it was sort of a new bill that took its place but didn't really put in place protections for the LGBT community like advocates had wanted originally.
And Katie's right. There has been and continues to be a lot of talk among advocacy groups about doing more. And remember, Governor Cooper at one point said he was committed to doing more, and so far I don't think much else has happened.
So HB2 might help him, Dan Bishop, in the primary. If he wins the primary, would it be a positive or a negative?
In the
general election.
I mean, I think this thing is going to be used against him as much as possible. Yeah. And I saw one headline like, will HB2 determine yet another election in North Carolina? And I think that this is, we're going to have to get a bigger jar over here because we're going to be talking about it a lot more.
Yeah, that was a story in Roll Call because it's still national.
Okay.
And he's moved past it, but yeah, I'm not sure if anyone else has.
I was going to say just one thing about that debate. On every issue that they talked about, every candidate on the stage stood with the president 100%. In every issue, maybe if it's like guns, there was no movement away from total protection of the Second Amendment, et cetera. That Lee Brown quote that you just played was kind of the only instance in a 2-hour debate in which one of the candidates questioned another candidate on policy. I mean, they've kind of gone after each other on like experience and character and stuff, but that was the only time a candidate said this conservative position that you took may have been the wrong thing.
Yeah, because it's been pretty steady guns, anti-abortion, pro-Trump, again and again and again. So you're right. I mean, it seems to be a primary that's all about personality, not so much policy differences.
It's very clear that agreeing with President Trump is just basically the Republican line at this point. You'll find, we're going to talk in the future about what's going on with the challenge to Tom Tillis, but it's pretty much who can be the closest to Trump.
Yeah.
And a big attack line among Republicans will be this person once disagreed with President Trump.
Well, Steve, you report that a poll by the National Journal last week put Dan Bishop in first place in this race with 31% of the vote. Is that because he has the widest name recognition, because he's a state senator, because of HB2, because of the money he spent on these TV ads that he's been running?
Yeah, I think yes, yes, yes. I mean, all that. And he's from Charlotte, too, right? So that's a huge, huge pool of voters here. The big thing in that poll put him at 31%. If he hits 31, he wins outright.
All right.
But then the other key thing, Stoney Rushing from Union County was in second, I think, at 19. So let's say Dan Bishop comes in at 29,
right,
and Stoney's in second. Rushing has said he will not ask for a runoff if he's in second.
Really?
So Dan Bishop
wins either way.
He's in a really good position, even if he doesn't hit 30.
Yeah.
And if he keeps Stoney in second, it's going to be hard for him to lose this.
But Stoney says, or at least he said at the debate, that he is the candidate with the broader appeal.
I'm not going to have any trouble bringing Democrats over, not like a Charlotte attorney is going to have, trying to bring Democrats in the Eastern District. I'm going to have a very easy time bringing conservative Democrats. They want to come to us. They want to join us. They can't stomach the babies on the table dying. They can't stomach the taxes. They can't stomach the Green New Deal, just like we can't stomach it.
So will moderate Democrats support Stoney Rushing in a general election? And if so, will that get him elected in the primary that attracts extremes? All primaries attract the extremes of the parties in which the primaries are being run.
Well, I think a couple of things here. I mean, let's remember in the primary, it's only Republicans and independents, so Democrats will not factor into that piece of it. The biggest thing that he has going for him is that he's from Union County, and obviously Union County was a big driver in Mark Harris's thought-to-be victory the last time around. So,
and he was a big supporter of Mark Harris and continues to be.
And
Mark Harris supports him.
Right, supports him. And remember, Stoney has been very critical of the State Board of Elections and how that transpired. So that's his best shot, is that he is in Union County and has that base of support.
So guns came up in this debate. Stoney Rushing is a concealed carry instructor, and he says that mass shootings could be prevented if more people carry. Fern Schubert, another of the candidates, told the audience shootings seem to happen in gun-free areas. These shooters may be crazy, but they're not stupid, she said. The Observer reported that analysts have disputed that claim. Stevie Rivenbark from, I think, down in Fayetteville says the fastest way to stop a bad guy with the gun is a good guy with a gun. We've heard that before. And State Senator Dan Bishop called gun violence a mental health issue that could be addressed in part by standing up for our societal values. What does that mean?
I think you're going to have a show with him on to parse that. I don't know what he meant.
But the clearest thing is that basically they all said it was either more guns, mental health, or they blamed the culture, video games, violence.
They may be right about that.
Yes, no one is going to say anything about control. As Steve said, basically the pro-gun point of view is the only one.
So early voting ends today. Election day is Tuesday. There are 10 candidates in the GOP primary. There's nobody running in the Democratic side. That's already been decided. How likely is a runoff?
Well, I mean, based on what Steve just said, which I think is entirely accurate, you would think right now that Dan Bishop has a pretty good shot at avoiding a runoff. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. If he does, then you have a general election that's set up in September, not in November. That's a big deal in terms of turnout and who comes out and votes. So that will make it infinitely more interesting, I think,
but
in a lot of ways.
The polls showed pretty double-digit undecideds, though. Mm-hmm. So we still aren't really sure of what's going to happen.
And there's so Lee Brown, the realtor from Cabarrus County, who mm-hmm. has the million-plus dollars from the realtor PAC, has had so much TV time. And Club for Growth, that is the D.C. group supporting Dan Bishop, they have put out some ads against her. And I think they see her as this because, you know, this huge wild card in the race, right? Has so much money, so little known about her. So I think that they see Stoney as their main competition, but also, like, we need to take out Lee Brown and not let her surge at the end.
Because evidently she's given to Democratic candidates in the past, and I think that's true. So,
well, according to the district, though, people forget that even though there was all the election fraud scandal, it's still gerrymandered to favor a Republican in the general.
So the 2020 campaign is actually underway in North Carolina. It's re-election time for North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis. And this week he got a GOP challenger, Garland Tucker III, the retired chairman and CEO of Triangle Capital Corporation and the author of Conservative Heroes, 14 Leaders Who Changed America, Jefferson to Reagan. Why is he challenging the incumbent?
Well, I think just looking at the tea leaves a little bit, Carter Wren seems to be the former campaign strategist for Jesse Helms seems to see vulnerability in Tillis. So you saw some of the comments that Carter Wren made this week. And there's a feeling in Republican circles this has been going on at least for a couple months since Tillis had the flip-flop on Trump and the emergency declaration for funding for the wall that Tillis is vulnerable. And he lost 12 points earlier this year in North Carolina. And so it was almost inevitable that somebody was going to challenge
him. Charles Helwig, who's the former Wake County GOP chairman, is serving as the campaign manager for Mr. Garland. He told the Raleigh News and Observer that Tom Tillis is, quote, sort of a typical Washington politician. Did he elaborate on that? What does that mean?
I don't know if he elaborated on it, but I mean, you're hearing the same thing again and again, that he is a creature of Washington, even though he's in his first term. And then, you know, you saw the Tillis camp fire back pretty quickly with the NNO editorial that Garland Tucker III had written right before the election in 2016, where he essentially said, "I'm only voting for Trump because I can't vote for Hillary Clinton. And I had four candidates that I favored before Donald Trump became the nominee." Well,
in that same op-ed, he said, Trump is, what was the exact quote, has said some of the most disgusting.
He said, and I quote, "He's a twice divorced, self-acknowledged adulterer who has, in the course of this campaign," meaning the 2016 campaign, "uttered some of the most unkind, disgusting comments ever made by any American politician." This is Garland Tucker's words. These are Garland Tucker's words, and he is now running against Tom Tillis because Tom Tillis does not support the president.
But this week, it's important to note, Carter Wren, who again is an advisor to Garland Tucker III, said that he now is aligned with the president.
Oh, yeah. I talked to him yesterday. Yeah. He loves President Trump.
A lot can happen in 2.5 years.
Well, again, you're seeing, you know, who can be closest to Trump. Now Tillis is basically saying, "I vote with Trump 90-some percent of the time."
And that is true. And except for the momentary blip where he wrote the op-ed editorial, I think, in the Washington Post declaring his opposition to declaring a national emergency at the border, which he then reversed, he is kind of in lockstep with the president. But Garland Tucker says that Tar Heel conservatives have a laundry list of grievances with the junior senator from Mecklenburg County.
The level of discontent was absolutely there long before the flip-flop on the emergency powers issue. I think it was there over spending. I think it was there over his proposal to prevent the president from firing Mueller. It was there over him trying to restrict the president. His ability to use tariffs for national security.
So does it matter in the Republican side of the aisle? Do issues matter at all? Is the only issue whether I stand 150% with the president? Is that it?
That seems to be the number one issue at this point.
Why is that the issue?
Well, because basically polls show that among Republicans, the support for President Trump is incredible. It's very high. And of course, there are the issues, as you say, guns, abortion. They're going to be talking about the Green New Deal, and they're going to say that Democrats are far left. So you do see just basically lockstep on issues, but it's embodied in the president.
Immigration, for sure.
Immigration,
I think, and I think a lot of it is strategic, like you said, Mary, where they look at the polls and realize that the voters support the president. But I think the candidates, I mean, I think Garland Tucker, maybe not as much as he says, but I think he supports the president.
But how do you explain Garland Tucker's flip-flop on his opinion with regard to the president and Lindsey Graham's flip-flop on his opinion with regard to the
people like winners?
Night and day, it's 180 degrees.
Once you win.
Don't they have a soul? Don't they have a conscience? Don't they have...
It doesn't really seem to matter. I mean, you can call people on hypocrisy, and I feel like voters' opinions tend to have short memories when it comes to that stuff. And I think there are probably a lot of Republicans who held their nose and voted for Trump.
But
last
do they
election.
Ever point? Do, given the severity of these flip flops, do they ever point to something that the president has done that caused that flip flop? Something verifiable that, yep, I'm going his way because this is what he did, and I'm on board with that.
Well, if you look at some of the issues like free trade, they're not traditional Republican issues.
All right, we
have
to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Katie Peralta is here from the Charlotte Observer, along with Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB-TV, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. The police shooting of Dancurius Franklin resulted in a series of body cam video releases that left some in our community complaining about a lack of transparency, and that has led the CMPD to change its video policy. On this program this week, the mayor applauded that change.
Going forward, we fixed it. Today, you could see that our policy has changed. Every single video in any case will go to the judge for review and release. And think about that. In another place, that might have taken a year to happen. It may have been something that never would have happened.
Is this an example of CMPD reacting to citizen concerns and working toward greater transparency? Are we doing something special here by being able to do this so quickly?
Well, I think what they're reacting to is a lot of media coverage about first you had the council that watches the video. What did they say? It was mistakenly they mistakenly saw an 11
all of it before the
all
judge
of it before the judge did. I mean, that answer still has not really been ever cleared up.
Well, the mayor said they made a mistake. They didn't know that they were in violation and they made a mistake.
Well, it seems like it was still a reaction rather than
right.
something that they did proactively. I mean, when we found out that the city council had seen it before the judge, I mean, I feel maybe it was Nick Oxner actually who tried to get the video for, I can't remember, but in any event, would this have happened had the media not gotten involved and, you know, kind of worked to get the whole video?
And I can't remember, Katie, if it was the Observer or BTV or both, but there was a question asked about why council was allowed to see it. And the answer was that Marcus Jones said, go ahead and show it.
So this change in policy means that all of the video, every nanosecond of video shot by body cams and by dash cams will now go to a judge. The judge will review this. Is this likely to end up being giving us more transparency, or could a judge just as easily decide not to show any of it to anybody?
Well, it is ultimately up to the judge. So, yes, the judge, I think, has ultimate authority.
So, to incentivize or not to incentivize, that was the question, whether it was nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of those opposed by offering an outrageous fortune to the team or by opposing ending the dream of Football USA in Rock Hill. Thank you, William Shakespeare.
I was going to say,
thank you. South Carolina delivers.
Who is rolling over in his grave.
South Carolina legislators, particularly in the Senate, have been debating this for weeks down there. But yesterday, they reached a decision on the final day of the session. What, prithee, was it?
Well, would you say it was Shakespearean? I don't know if you'd say that. But I think, in essence, what this boiled down to was when this was announced in March, most of us thought, this is going to skate through because you had the governor, you had the leaders of the legislature, and you had a fair amount of Democrats that supported this. And then Dick Harpootlian, who's a Democratic senator down there, I've learned to spell his name after all these references, really held the bill up and asked a lot of pointed questions about some of the estimates and how this was being negotiated. But in the end, yesterday afternoon, they approved it. And so now it will end up going to the governor.
So I've heard two figures, $115 million, $120 million. Which is it? They're tax incentives.
Yes,
it's not cash.
They're tax incentives, and they're based on payroll, and so there is a little room for fluctuation there.
Okay.
Essentially, you're talking about $150, $160 million, because remember, there's also a $40 million, give or take, interchange at I-77 that would be built near this headquarters site. That seemed to be the bigger sticking point, really, than the
$150 million. Panthers owner asked for that, or is that something that they know they have to do if they allow a facility of this size?
We've never really gotten an answer on that.
Okay. So this would exempt Panthers players, coaches, and employees from state income taxes in South Carolina for 15 years. But isn't that only if they move their residences to South Carolina?
No, it's where you work. It's not where you live.
But aren't NFL players taxed in the city in which they play?
That is, Katie, you've done a lot more on the so-called jock tax, so I will cede to your expertise.
And it seems like there was somewhat of an attempt to acknowledge that yesterday. I cannot remember the guy's name. Some senator, put in a proposal that they play two games a year in South Carolina.
Oh, Larry Grooms, yes, yeah.
Thank you.
Where?
Grooms.
At Williams-Brice?
At Clemson or Williams-Brice.
Okay.
Right, in order to take advantage of some of that income tax. Because
that will happen never.
Exactly. It would have been a logistical nightmare. So, eight of the games per year will still be played at Bank of America Stadium, where, you know, the team's highest paid employees, a.k.a. the players, will be taxed. And, you know, they've gotten pretty creative. I think it was McMaster who pointed to the $190 million, annual payroll for federal tax purposes as the figure that they used. And that doesn't mean that South Carolina will reap all of the benefits of that $190 million.
So this is being described as Republican Governor Henry McMaster. Greatest legislative accomplishment since taking office from Nikki Haley when she was appointed UN ambassador. If this goes through, will this go down in South Carolina history books as...
Wait, it is? Seriously, who's saying that?
I don't know.
I think
it's in the news. Read the news.
No, not the NNO. Sorry, the state.
Yeah,
really?
State. Yeah.
Newspaper, yeah.
Okay.
I think Jordan Rodney tweeted yesterday, it will be interesting to see down the line. You know, you could play what if all day long. It's interesting to think about, would they have still done this had South Carolina not offered all of these millions of dollars in tax incentives? And the answer is, who knows? But for a long time, David Tepper has talked about being two states, one team.
Yeah.
This is following the norm in the league, having your practice facilities and, you know, corporate offices in another location. I mean, the Frisco or the Star in Frisco is about 40 miles from downtown Dallas. That's the Cowboys facility. So this is very much the norm. It was not a surprise. And at the end of the day, yes, it is a huge legislative win, but they're probably going to use it more for recruiting other businesses too. It's a very, I've heard the term used, sexy asset. You know, it's a thing you can brag about.
Well, David Tepper has said many times it's the team of two Carolinas, and that's a marketing thing. But as the legislature was hemming and hawing, he was also seeming rather unemotional about their indecision.
You know, they'll have to make a decision if they want it or not. Otherwise, I got a bubble. You guys see the bubble going up there? I got a cafeteria building. I'll stay in Charlotte. I can stay home.
So that could be a negotiating tactic, I suppose, because there is no place like home, after all. The bubble he's talking about is the practice bubble that's going up next to the stadium so that they can play out of the elements, or practice out of the elements. So with that, why are they interested in moving? They got everything your heart might desire right here at home.
Well, like Katie's saying, though, the contemporary version is to really have a complex that has a sports medicine center, that has a nutrition center, that has all these elements, not just sort of stuffed into the basement of a stadium, which is what they're working with now.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
And you'll continue to hear, of course, the debate that this person who's very wealthy and team that's very wealthy, they're getting these breaks, and South Carolinians have many other needs. So you'll continue to hear that.
So nearly 2 weeks ago, we talked a lot about this last week, there was the tragic shooting of two students at UNC Charlotte, four wounded, two deaths. Now details about the shooter are beginning to come out. It's been revealed that eyewitnesses told the police that the shooter walked toward a particular table and began to fire at the people seated there in that classroom. That seems to line up with a difficult-to-understand comment made by the shooter to reporters as he was led into CMPD headquarters. It was caught on tape. A reporter asked what happened. He responded by saying something like, "I just ran into a classroom and shot the guy." Do these two things make people believe that certain people were targeted?
It sounds like maybe. If he was looking at one table, I mean, I don't think anything's come out about any personal relationship he might have had with the victims or anything like that. But I think this adds another layer of complexity and confusion to an already really heartbreaking and, you know, confusing, horrible situation.
Police also searched the shooter's apartment. What did they find?
In Novel Nota, I think it was, they found some sort of ammunition or something, magazines. Yeah.
And police have revealed that when UNCC campus police, who were the first responders, entered the room after responding to the 911 call, the police asked who was shooting, and the shooter identified himself and then was taken into custody. What are we to make of this? The guy just gave himself up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of that. I don't have a good answer for that one.
UNC Charlotte's going to be conducting, as they have said, a complete investigation to see what they can learn and what policies and procedures might be improved, although everybody's getting glowing reports on the speed with which they operated in this incident. They're also deciding what to do with the classroom in which this occurred. Do we know what they're considering?
They have, a 14-member commission that has been set up, and they're going to talk about that this summer. From what we've heard so far, it sounds like it's very early, and they don't know exactly what to do, but they know that they want to do something, obviously.
And they're also, that the 14-member commission is also tasked with trying to decide how to honor the two victims, Riley Howell and Ellis Parlier. Riley, who has been described as the hero of this incident because he gave his life in an attempt to take down the shooter, was shot three times. His parents say he took two bullets to the body, which did not deter him. It was the third and final shot that ended his life. It was at point-blank range, evidently. And Riley Howell has been widely praised in life as being a daredevil, unafraid of anything, and as a hero because of what he did in this instance. Kevin Westmoreland, who is Riley Howell's girlfriend's father, said that he was initially wary of this big, handsome boy dating his daughter. But at the funeral, he fought back tears as he remembered him.
I choose to believe that Riley knew that some things were bigger than he was, and he was right where he was supposed to be. Maybe it was to show all of us in the world that selflessness is not gone. We just don't see it enough. He showed it in small ways through his life, and finally, in the ultimate way.
Theoden James wrote a beautifully written story about the Parlier family and about how they have been handling their grief privately. They don't want cameras to record them in their personal moments of grief over the loss of their son, Reed. But Theoden James wrote that his parents, Brian and Julie Parlier, are clear about one thing, and that is that they want people to know what made Reed so special to them and why they will miss him so much. This also emerged from that story, the fact that as the larger picture story developed through the media, it became clear that Riley Howell, the other student who lost his life, had demonstrated extraordinary bravery after the shooting began, tackling the gunman, and police confirmed saving lives. But stories about the victims of the attack have had a tendency to focus on Riley Howell almost exclusively, and there's a sentence about Reed, and the parents are worried that Reed will be forgotten. His mom told Theoden James, "I'm so sorry for the Howell family, and I think that their son is definitely a hero. I don't want to take anything away from Riley and his parents, but I'm not going to lie. At night, I sometimes pull up the news and I read articles, and you know, I see this much about one student," and she holds one hand over the other, palms facing about a foot apart, "and this much about Reed," she says, and she closes the gap between her palms to about 2 inches. "My friends are upset," she says. "The family's upset. Not that Riley's getting attention, because he definitely deserves it, but what about our son? We don't want him to be forgotten." You wrote about this in Roll Call, Mary, in which you said that now, because of this incident, Charlotte is one of those cities.
Yes. And, you know, it happened when my son was born in Tucson, and then after Gabby Giffords happened, that became one of those cities. And, you know, since this has happened, we've seen another shooting in Colorado.
Right.
Another young man, Kendrick Castillo, I want to say his name, who gave his life, and we're asking kids to be heroes. And an article.
One dead, eight injured, two suspects in that shooting.
Yes, and there was a good article, Nick Kristoff in the New York Times, who said parents don't want heroes, they want children and grandchildren. And it's still going to be an issue, of course, in the 2020 campaign. We see the Democratic candidates coming out with gun policies, Kamala Harris, John Hickenlooper, and others, Cory Booker, who's making a Charlotte appearance, talking about gun violence. And so this is going to be a big debate still. But every day, someplace else becomes one of those cities, and it doesn't even make the top of the news often now.
Right.
And that is a shame.
In South Carolina, some lawmakers there in that state will soon pass a hate crimes bill, it seems. The House Criminal Laws Subcommittee voted Wednesday to advance a proposal that would make it a felony for someone to assault, intimidate, or threaten a person because of race, religion, sex, age, national origin, sexual orientation, or homelessness. Why is that bill coming to the South Carolina legislature now?
Well, it's been wanted for years and years, and I believe South Carolina is one of only four states that doesn't
yes.
have a law like that on the books. And when – I mean, to just take the most obvious example, the tragedy at Mother Emanuel in 2015, it is mind-boggling that there's not a
yes.
law like this.
That's
in
when
place.
Charleston became a city like
yeah.
that, and it will be ever tainted by that.
So, Pike's Soda Shop, which is where you can go and get a milkshake, and that milkshake will contain a half gallon of ice cream. For those who have never been there, you should know that before they close, because they're going to close. Why?
They said that they're relocating, actually, so that will be apparently a temporary closure, but we have heard that from other longtime restaurants who say that they're relocating. So I don't want to jinx anything, but they blame it on parking. You know, South End is a booming area. They want to be in a place that better serves their patrons.
Right. Well, we'll look forward to a new location soon because I got to get another one of those milkshakes. So are you wondering who the new Miss USA is?
And now, Miss USA 2019 is North Carolina.
She's 28-year-old Charlotte attorney Chelsea Crist. She was Miss Fort Mill High School and the prom queen during her teen years. She's now with Pointer Spruill, a law firm uptown. This is significant, right?
Yeah, all three, Miss USA, Miss Teen, and Miss America, are African-American women. You might say beauty pageants are retrograde, but you know what? African-American female beauty has not been exalted, and now it is.
Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Katie Peralta from The Observer, Eric Spanberg from The Business Journal, Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.